This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Keith Clark.
Yes.
And I am Finlay Mason. Now, Keith, you've had a long career in education. It didn't start in this area. It was actually far down on the South Island.
Yes. I was born in Richmond, Nelson, in 1928, and my parents, Lionel Clark, my dad, he was a cheese and butter maker at Waimea Dairy Factory, and my mother was a psychiatric nurse at Nelson. So that was the sort of beginning. My ancestors were the early pioneers into Nelson. And my great-great-great-grandfather was remarkable for exploring through to the Buller and found the road to the Buller. So there's a Clark River and a Clark Mountain and a Clark Valley, all in that particular area, named after his success at that stage. So my grandfather was a sawmiller and farmer, and my other grandfather, he was a foreman of a big a gang that was doing the railways between Nelson and through almost to the Buller River again. So they were outstanding men in their time, yeah, and it was interesting. So at a very early age, we moved to Karamea. My dad got the first assistant's job there, and so my first memories of there was at about the age of three or four, when I had the chance to. My mother used to give me a penny, and I would tricycle down to the local store, which was about 100 yards away, and I'd pass my penny over to the storekeeper, and he would do a big grin and come out with a little white bag, and I could choose brandy balls and black balls and peppermints and things like that to fill my little bag. And so that was a great occasion. And then I remember the white baiting too, going white baiting with my mother. And we used to have a big scoop net, and that net would, you'd pull it along the river area where it was fairly deep, and often you'd come up with 8 or 10 pounds of white bait in one scoop, and we'd fill a billy, usually half a kerosene tin or something, and take that home, and we'd just pour the white bait into the frying pan and put a knob of butter in, and that was it. We'd have a meal. And what was, we'd eat that, and any that was wasted went to the hens or somebody like that. So so that was early life. And I can remember learning to spear flounder at about five. I got my first flounder with a broom handle and a 4-inch nail on it, and an old lantern, carbide lantern, which was a fascinating sort of old thing. And so that was my early start in life.
And you started your schooling at Karamea then? Your father was still part of the dairy factory?
Yes, he was the butter maker there. Right. And And I first started school there, and that was at the age of six. And my first day at school was a bit of a disaster because I wouldn't go without my bow and arrow. And at playtime, there was a bully boy in about, I suppose, standard one at the time, a bit bigger than I was anyway, and he came and gave me a good thumping. First, you know, the first day in, I suppose, he thought he'd better have a go at me. So I rushed in, grabbed my bow and arrow, and hit him fair and square. Well, did I get a hiding from the infant lady at the time? And then I got home, got another hiding, and they took my bow away. So that was my start to school. And at seven, Dad got the job of factory manager at Arahura, general manager of the dairy factory at Arahura Valley, which was near Hokitika. Mm-hmm. And so it's the Greenstone Valley of the Maoris. That was an isolated little valley, no power, and the factory was operated by a steam engine. And so that was a fascinating life for a while because I used to go over there often into the factory, especially weekends, and I learnt, you know, how to work the big boiler and how to grade cream and all sorts of things. And in time, that was a very important thing to me. Anyway, school was 2 miles away, and I had to walk. Rain, hail, shine. And of course, it was bare feet those days. So we used to have. I had a pair of shoes, but I used to poke those in the hedge on the way to school and get them on the way home. And it was a gravel road and pretty isolated. I was the only child for about 2 miles around. It was good. I liked going to school because I met everybody. It was Kai Hinu School, food aplenty, and then and we had about 50% were Maoris in the school, the Tainui's and the Masons and the Tauwharis and Tainui's. Oh, there were a whole group of Maori kids that we used to play with.
Small farm lots, the school populations were quite reasonable in number in those days. What sort of role would that school have had?
It wasn't a big factory. There were probably about 20 suppliers of cream, and they were in the cream was in all kinds of quantities. Some had little billies, some just had cans, and some had two cans. The farms were small, with something like ranging about, the general one was about 30 to 40 cows. 30 cows, 40 was a big farm. The whole area was owned by the Maoris, so they were all pretty well on lease, 3 monthly leases. They had to pay every 3 months or so into that sort of account. It was a very fertile valley, and it was a very nice community. People used to work as a community there.
You had the sort of community facilities, a local hall.
We had a local hall. And once a month, all the community, all those that could, met at the hall. And we had games of cards for a start. I very early learned to play euchre and 500 and or a game called 45s on the West Coast, another similar to euchre in a way. And then we would have a band would arrive. and we would have dancing until about 9 or 10 o'clock. Then when we used to have a gorgeous supper made of cream cakes about 6 inches high and all the cream puffs and cream horns and everything like that you can imagine. And it was fascinating that there were very few young people, but everybody had to dance. So they got all the children up to dance with the adults as well. So I became a partner in the Lancets and the Alberts, and then they went on to the Lucky or the Foxtrots and Waltzes and Palais Glides and all those very early kind of dances that we had. So I learned all those very early from about 7 on, and it was an occasion when sometimes the Cockatoo Band would come across from another valley over, and they were a fascinating band. They were all in Bojangs and with a red... they're still going, and they dress up in colourful clothes, and they play the violin and a concertina and a piano, and sometimes drums. So it was a fascinating background there.
Was the family still in that area when you reached sort of secondary school age?
I have no family down there at all.
When you, as you grew up through your schooling, were you still in that area by the time you reached school age, secondary school age?
Yes, I was. I really didn't go very much to school. My mother, in March, used to go hop picking up at Nelson. We had family with hop gardens up there. So she would go off in March and take me with her, and I would spend a month or more out in the hop fields picking hops at sixpence a bushel. And that was... I'd earned quite a substantial amount in a matter of a month, and that was very good. And then we'd come home again, and then the season would end in those days. The dairy cows were dried off, and the factory then had to be maintained. So everything was pulled a bit, so the pulleys were taken apart and put new bearings in. All the whole maintenance of the factory was then carried out very thoroughly. And so there was about a month of maintenance like that. And then Dad would have a month's holiday, and we would go back up to Nelson again. And this time, it would be my grandfather's. I'd go to the grandfather's, and they would... They were wonderful sportsmen. Bill Doidge was my grandfather in Belgrove, and he was one of Nelson's cricketers. He was a great, good cricketer, but he was also a marvellous fisherman, fly fisherman, and also a marvellous shot on quail. So I grew up with that sort of background all the time.
You grew up with a lot of these rural schools, but your education had its gaps in it, though, from time to time.
Yes, big gaps, yes. I don't know, the teachers seemed to push me on all the time, and I jumped from Standard 1 to Standard 3, and then they missed out Form 1 as well. So I ended up, I was 12 with leaving certificate, and... I was just sort of I was 12 starting secondary school, and that was okay from a point of view of maybe I could keep up with them intellectually, but I was socially out of gap, and I'd never let any of my family that happen to them again. I've got great grandkids in Auckland who are very bright, and I haven't let, I've made sure they're keeping in their social group all the way through.
Yeah.
And so school for a start was not easy.
And where was that?
In Hokitika District High School. And but I made sure that I they on the first day I was there that my class teacher said, oh, we don't take notice much of these people who come to our school with high credentials. We don't believe the country ones stand up to the city ones. So, oh, it was wild with him. And I said, I'll fix it. So I made sure I came up at the top in most of the things, but in both the half-year and final-year exam. So so that was going to high school. But it was a difficult 6 miles to bike each way.
Yeah.
And again, at one stage, I went through a tremendous lightning and thunderstorm and woke up on the side of the road with a pole down right across and electric wires all around me and the lady in the house just opposite screaming with the roof off, some bits off the roof. Took me a week to get over that. I had a headache for well over a week, and I still get slight headaches whenever there's a thunderstorm around, so interesting. But I did well at school. I was very fit with the biking all the time, and so I became very good at the 100 and 220 and long jump, those sort of ones, and I got into the first 15 on the wing for my speed. And I got into cricket because I could throw a ball and bowl a ball very well, not because of my batting, but more because of my fielding skills. So I made my way, okay, and what I really enjoyed was the cadets at the time. It was wartime, the cadets became very important to the army as young people coming on. And so we had army guys who used to come along and teach us all sorts of skills with marching and then guns. And I'd been used to guns since I was about 9 or 10. And so I'd learnt to use a single shot 22 at about 10, and at about 11 or 12 I was with a shotgun and shot my first deer at that sort of stage with a 303. So guns were part of my life as it was. So I was a marksman straight away, and I used to help teach the young third formers at the time how to sight a rifle with a sort of scope thing that could show you how they were sighting, and I could see that their sights were not right, and they'd shut their eyes and pull the trigger and all sorts of things like that. And so it was a teaching moment for me, I suppose. And then they used to use me for home guard rifles. The Americans sent a shipload or so of 30-06s, Springfields, and a lot of the rifles that had a fair bit of use, and so they needed to be checked out. So I got hauled out of school and up to the range, and I'd bang away for a week with these Springfields, firing three shots, and the armourer would be there, and he would adjust the sights according to where it grouped, and that rifle would be passed, and the next one wouldn't group and would go all over the place. So he'd throw that aside somewhere. So we'd go through all these rifles that way. Incredible experience for a boy of, you know, 40 to 15.
And those rifles were subsequently issued to what? To the Home Guard?
Yes. Yeah, Home Guard rifles.
Yes.
And what was better still, at that stage our heavy rifles had been taken from us in the country area. And we only had 22s left or shotguns left. So it was, you know, the sergeant in charge of it would say to me, "Would you like 10 rounds of ammunition and a rifle for the weekend?" Did I ever? So I'd be off and I'd be, there were deer and rabbits and things everywhere at that stage because there was no one shooting them.
Yeah.
And I'd come back with a haunch of venison for him on Monday morning or something like that. So it was very hilarious experiences then. I was a sergeant then at that stage, and they eventually, the last year I was there, the Japanese were very close at that stage. They'd been sighted here and there around, and they got me to form a Bren gun squad. And I had four boys, myself on the gun, somebody with a spare barrel to change it as we fired, and two others that were loading ammunition into magazines as we needed to. And I had a space where I could go that covered the Hokitika beach area in the case of an invasion. So
you weren't issued with the Bren gun carrier then, the troop carrier?
No, it was just the gun itself, and and we had about a couple of thousand rounds of ammunition on hand if we needed it. So fascinating part of my life. Anyway, I sat School C. I got public service exams in the fourth form, School C and UE in the fifth form. 15, didn't know what to do with myself. A chemist offered me an apprenticeship, and I couldn't exactly see myself in that sort of job. So I decided I'd come back for the sixth form, and did so. And then one of the factory hands had an accident, and not at the factory, but outside with a car, and it was I was the skilled person around, and so the factory people went to the board of the school and said, "Can we come to some sort of arrangement that Keith can work at the factory in the morning, come to school in the afternoon, because essential industry, he's needed,
yeah,
and he's the only one that's got the skills around that can do the job." So 5 in the morning,
yes,
work in the factory,
yes,
out with the first load of butter, and then all the men would come in. It was great with all the men coming in with their buggies or their old Model T cars,
yeah,
or trucks, and their old some horses with drays and things like that. So they all used to come in with their cream, and that was a great talking point. And my mum was the postmistress in this little place at the time. So they'd go over to her, and she'd have scones usually, and a cup of tea, and a game of cards going somewhere or other. So it was a great sort of experience, and it was interesting that in the valley, if you had a dozen eggs to spare, you'd pass it on to somebody who didn't. If you shot a deer, and you didn't need very much of it yourself, you'd pass it around the valley, and there was all sorts of that going on. It was a sort of situation you don't see very much today. It was a case of everybody looked after everybody else. And I thought that was a fascinating part of that time in my life. My dad was an expert butter maker and became New Zealand's top butter maker. He won all the prizes and cups and medals and things like that at the Waikato Show every year. And so... He he did extremely well with his butter making. Anyway, I worked on that year with at the factory, and I got higher leaving certificate at the end of the year. I don't know that I did a terrible amount of work at school that year, because we were left more or less on our own to work, and so it was up to me to do whatever work I could. And anyway, next year I had enough money to go to Canterbury University. So 1945 found me at just 16 at the university, far too young. And suddenly I was from a very rural background into a big city and complex, you know, and thousands of students around, and a different lifestyle. I had terrible board that wasn't, it was only just a little outhouse thing that I had a bed in. And
that was the only accommodation that was available for students, yes, at that time, wasn't it? Yeah. It wasn't the hostels or flatting or anything like that.
No, it was you had to get a board somewhere.
Yeah.
And this was an auntie I was boarding with, but she was kind, but they weren't very well off either, so it was an existence that was difficult for me, and I went home. However, I coped, and I joined. I was in the CUC rifle team, and won thousands of rounds of ammunition, and I played third grade rugby there.
And lost. Studied along the way as well.
Beg your pardon?
And studied along the way.
Studied
as well?
Along the way.
What
yes.
was your
I did a BSc. Started on a BSc.
Right.
Maths, physics, chemistry.
Yeah.
In May, I went home for the holidays. It was the war. Time was over, and I met up with three of my old friends in Hokitika, and we decided to do a trek up the Arahura River. There was an old Maori trail up the river towards where the greenstone was, the site of the greenstone reef, if you like, so right up the valley. So we decided to go, and we got three horses, and unfortunately they were retired race horses, and as soon as we got onto a bit of flat land, they decided they were going to race, and they'd all wanted to take off, and here were we bumping along with packs and rifles and everything like that. Oh, that wasn't the experience. We had to cross the river several times by horse, and then we got up into it, by a day up into it, started to rain, and it poured as it only can in Westland. Mm-hmm. And the river rose, and we couldn't get either forward or back. So we had to find a camp stretch somewhere, and luckily we had some food with us and tea and so on. And we tried to stay warm without succeeding. We all got wet and damp and cold, and we had to wait 3 days for the river to go down, and then we had to swim the horses some part of the time. Got back and went on back over to Christchurch, and then I suddenly got ill. Mm-hmm. And the doctor said, back home for you. You've got yellow jaundice, and I don't think it's very good. I think you'd be better back into your home area. Forget about it.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
support this programme and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.